We're delighted to see so many of you here today, friends of the university, friends of Dr. Patty and Mrs. Patty, and we welcome you to see the presentation of the Catherine Stanton Patty Memorial to the university by the Fairbanks Garden Club and the Top of the World Garden Club. We are sorry that Dr. Patty couldn't make it today, but we have a letter from him which I would like to read. Dr. Patty says, "Will you express for me to the Fairbanks Garden Club and the Top of the World Garden Club my deepest appreciation for the honor they are extending to Kay? She loved this garden and spent many hours working there. The memorial would make her very happy. Perhaps she knows about it. I want to believe so. I have marked my calendar, and at 4 p.m. Fairbanks time, I will sit quietly here in the house and be with you in spirit." Some people in this world leave a path of glory behind them. They give their spirit to the land where they have been, and it remains forever a part of the soil, the trees, the shrubs, and the sky. Catherine Stanton Patty was this kind of person, and this memorial and this little garden spot are part of her path of glory. It is my privilege now to present a very dear friend of Kay's and a member of the Alaska Federation of Garden Clubs, Alta Crawford.
Thank you, Marion. Friends of the university, many of you will remember when this hillside was cleared for the construction of a residence for the president of the university. Trees were felled, brush and moss removed by bulldozers, and the rough spots smoothed by graders. Later came excavation for the house itself, piles of building material, lumber and stone, steel and glass littered the hillside. When the structure was nearing completion, landscaping was undertaken. Certain birch and spruce trees had been left in the yard. Others were planted. Ornamental shrubs and flowers were set out around the house. At about this time, Catherine Patty, one of the early members of the Fairbanks Garden Club, had the inspirational thought that an area should be reserved for the propagation of native flora, a place set aside for informal planting that all visitors to the university could enjoy. Accordingly, she and Dr. Patty commenced the collection of specimens. Whenever they returned to the campus from trips around the state, the trunk of their car was usually loaded with plants and small shrubs. Although her husband did most of the planting, it was under Catherine Patty's direction that the specimens were placed. A spot was found for the high bush cranberry, Labrador tea, native spirea, wild rose, and baneberry with its bright red fruit. Seeds of the yellow Arctic poppy were scattered in fertile places. Wild iris, bluebells, and ferns were transplanted, and many others. Catherine did much of the cultivating and described herself as a plain dirt gardener. She loved watching the development of every flower and bush, and remembered, often with a humorous description, where each had been obtained. The plants responded to her skillful and loving care. The few replacements now necessary are due to the winter activities of rabbits and moose. When the members of the Fairbanks Garden Club and the Top of the World Gardeners were considering a suitable marker for the garden, Dr. Otto William Geist, who had been associated with the university for many years, offered a boulder which had come from the Kobuk River Jade region. It was felt that a stone found in the state of Alaska would be in keeping with the spirit of the garden. In dedicating this area to the memory of its originator, the garden club members trust that these native plantings will continue to thrive and that they will give pleasure to all who view them. And we hope that you, Dorothy Wood, will enjoy the garden, and we ask that you accept this site as a memorial to Catherine Stanton Patty.
Friends of the University, in behalf of the University of Alaska and the community of Fairbanks, I accept this memorial in tribute to Catherine Patty, wife of our President Emeritus, Ernest N. Patty. I extend appreciation for the University to the Garden Clubs for planning and creating this special event honoring the memory of Mrs. Patty. And also a special thanks to our gardener, Ron Newman, and his assistants for their efforts in placing and setting the jade boulder of the Kobuk in position. May this memorial be a lasting symbol and reminder of Mrs. Patty's efforts and her genuine enthusiasm and interest in stimulating other people to keep Alaska beautiful. And I would like to quote now from Dorothy Gurney's God's Garden. The kiss of the sun for pardon, the song of the birds for mirth. One is nearer God's heart in a garden than anywhere else on earth. Thank you.
We want to thank you all for coming, and we want to especially thank Dr. and Mrs. Wood, without whose cooperation this memorial presentation couldn't possibly have been. But I also want to give credit where credit is due to Mary Jean Payway. She has done a tremendous job in planning every bit of it, and she was the one that helped secure the jade for us from Dr. Otto Geist. So I think we should all give Mary Jean Payway an ovation also. Goodbye, Dr. Pay. I hope you've enjoyed this.
Is to be an efficacious sermon, at least. Wouldn't you say that's true?
About the only charge I think you can make of her at the end is where she agrees to skip the country with Dimmesdale. Other than that, she's not humble, in as the Puritans may have wished. It had the opposite effect of giving her an inverse pride.
Mm. It's what Shakespeare said about Coriolanus, that he wore his humble weeds proudly. And that's precisely what she does.
Even beyond that, there is the deliberate, one of those nice details that she embroiders the letter A, that she makes it actually a glorious symbol. If Hester is a sermon against sin, she is also a sermon that says that if you are sinful, and certainly the Christian position is that man is eventually sinful in some way or other, he can't help it, that the thing to do is to face your punishment and then go on and live as well as you can afterward. Mm.
But the elaboration of the A here, I think, proceeds from the nature of her character. Hawthorne remarks that she had in her nature a rich, voluptuous, oriental characteristic, a taste for the gorgeously beautiful, and in decking out the adulterous A with a kind of a scarlet carnival atmosphere. I think she's giving vent here to her gorgeously
oriental voluptuous. Well, as such, and also for the fact that the adultery lies itself lies entirely before the story, our attention isn't drawn to sin here, but to the reaction to guilt. And there too, there is a kind of voluptuousness on a more more internal level with Dimmesdale and his self-flagellation. He runs through a beautiful set of symptoms of guilt and devises all sorts of tortures for himself, reaching a final high point in the trying to duplicate Hester standing on the platform, exposed to the scorn of the crowd, and doesn't realize that this is entirely valueless because he does it at night when nobody's around. He's just going to stand up there. It seems as if he's lost sight of all values, all proportions, and he's lost in this world of guilt. Guilt overwhelms him and drives him to a kind of madness.
He seems to try half measures first. That is, he'll give a little and that doesn't work, and then he'll try the next, and finally he makes a scaffold at noontime with the crowd.
But this is... When this happens, there are two things necessary. First, this is the end of the novel. And secondly, it is the end of Dimmesdale.
And third, that's a part of the staging.
Yeah, right.
It's a beautiful pageant, though.
Oh, it is. In a later novel, The Marble Faun, Hawthorne has a study of a Protestant girl in Rome. And she, if I remember correctly, is troubled by... some anxiety. And being a Protestant, she actually goes to confession in the Catholic church. Mm-hmm. And Hawthorne seems to be saying here that this kind of confession, either privately in the church to a priest or in public as Dimmesdale did it in The Scarlet Letter, is rather a salutary, that an individual needs some way of getting it off his chest. And many people have been puzzled by the fact that Hawthorne would permit this Protestant girl to carry through with this. The priest himself was quite disturbed in the novel, but he had sufficient perspicacity to recognize what the compulsion was. Now, in all of Hawthorne's work, I have a feeling that his people have a compulsion to confess publicly or to confess to someone any sense of guilt that they might have.
Well, Hawthorne himself had this. He said in his notes on writing that you should make sure that your words agreed with your deepest feelings and that there was no value or less value in telling your feelings to a close friend than to the whole world by writing about it.
Do you have a feeling, Letitia, that Hawthorne's novels represent a kind of confession on his part? Can you make that biographical inference? Is he guilt-ridden?
I don't know. About the only thing he seems to feel guilty for is the years at Old Manse when he was a recluse and hid from society and this Jacksonian brotherhood. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, his ancestors did actually participate in the Salem witch hunts.
Yeah.
And apparently, biographers think nowadays that from this he derived a considerable... a sense of guilt, and he was always trying to expiate it in some way.
I think he makes this pretty clear in The Scarlet Letter in that opening chapter on the customs house where supposedly he derived the records from which he reconstructed the story of Hester and of Dimmesdale, that he feels an overburdening sense of his own Puritan background, and that the guilt for Puritanism itself is bad, I'm sure, to Hawthorne's sense of value.
I don't think so, Tom.
I think so entirely, and this is exactly why. That it was a kind of, to him, it's a kind of perfectionism that is just simply inhuman. A great many of the other stories like The Birthmark and Rappaccini's Daughter, point to the necessity of a mixture of good and evil, and that either, in its pure sense, cannot exist, that we have to accept that the greatest beauty, as in the Birthmark, is still slightly tainted with that birthmark, that touch of mortality, of the imperfection of earth. Mm-hmm. That the girl, that Rappaccini's daughter, has been turned into a creature who lives upon evil influences, mm-hmm. evil perfumes and such, and that because she has been, to the opposite extreme, completely corrupted, mm-hmm. she can't live in the normal world either.
Well, I think he charges the Puritans with blindness and narrowness and bigotry, but never with unworthiness. I have a feeling that he treats these people with considerable respect, nearly always.
With a respect for the fact that they could be such extremists.
Well, he admires their introspection, their hunting out of evil, but I don't know if you mean Puritanism as a way of life or as a religious teachings. For example, Dimmesdale comes the closest to a predestinist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Hawthorne shows in Scarlet Letter that Hester and Dimmesdale are free to change. That mm-hmm. They do have free will
mm-hmm.
and conscious choice. There would be no tragedy. Mm-hmm.
Throughout Hawthorne's work, especially in the Blaisdell Romance, for example, he has a real vitriolic hatred for reformers, people who tamper with what he calls the sanctity of the human heart. Now, the admirable thing about the Puritans, granted their bigotry and their provincialism and their narrowness, they did recognize limitations placed upon the individual. They may have been transcendental limitations, all right, but no one, according to Hawthorne, had license to meddle with the human being and the human heart. As a matter of fact, he says of Roger Chillingsworth in The Scarlet Letter that his crime was, quote, he violated the sanctity of the human heart. That's his greatest crime.
Yes, but notice there are a number of differences from Puritanism here, and essential differences. For one thing, there is free will. Free will is admitted within the framework of the Scarlet Letter. And second, the essence of Puritanism in practice in 17th century America in the Massachusetts Bay Colony did meddle with the human heart. It saw no reason not to tamper with any human activity, and beyond that, even into the human psychology, that one must think exactly along certain lines, that to think otherwise was sinful. And if it were sinful, this was a civil crime that could be punished by the legal apparatus of the mm-hmm. of the colony also. Now this is this to me is the nature of Puritanism and the influence of it that has come down into the United States in the 20th century in such things as censorship of supposedly immoral novels and immoral movies, through many kinds of restrictions that tamper with the individual human life
mm-hmm.
and the individual human personality.
Yes, but can't you applaud their industry, their integrity, granted that it's limited?
Yes, but this is like applauding a busy demon.
I wanted to ask Letitia what she thought of Pearl in the novel. She's called the messenger of anguish. Is she ever a child to you?
Yes and no. Hawthorne is awfully heavy-handed on Pearl as
yeah, you know, he called this
embodiment
a novel without any sunshine.
It seems to reflect on Pearl constantly. Pearl does have mannerisms. I think his understanding of the child is impish and also very loving. Perhaps reflects his experience with his own daughter. She's made into this witcher, elfish, whatever that goes, creature, and yet she becomes quite human on the scaffold when finally Dimmesdale arrives on the scene and makes a threesome.
Mm-hmm.
Then Hawthorne says she becomes a normal, happy, loving child.
Well, I object to her prescience. She knows just the right question to ask Dimmesdale, which will persecute him.
Oh, come now, haven't you seen children do this to adults? they often have a talent for picking up the exactly the right detail to persecute an adult.
Consistently.
I've seen some that were pretty well practiced at it.
Well, I think this is beside the point, isn't it, really? It's a book. It doesn't have to be... Pearl doesn't have to be realistic as the kid next door is realistic. I actually think
at some point she is. And to me in the novel, and this is one of the things that delights me about it, Pearl is the nearest to a spontaneous, real human being in the whole thing.
Yes, but that's because of her background, if you like. She's the product of sin, and as such, her constitution is disorderly and
but only in the Puritan framework.
Well, Hawthorne says that she was an imp, imp of evil, emblem and product of sin. That's what she is.
And isn't this the human fate in any strictly Christian sense?
No.
This is what the human is, certainly. No. The product of sin. The whole concept of original sin proceeds from that.
I don't think the Samoans would agree with you at all, Tom.
Well, only... They would agree since conversion.
No, I'm not certain that Hawthorne would agree with you either.
For example, in Young Goodman Brown, the devil says mankind is evil, but Hawthorne never says it. He has a devil say this instead.
No, but I'm sure, and I would argue this from anything that Hawthorne wrote, that Hawthorne argues that pure goodness is also inhuman.
Oh, yes.
And their ideas as my main argument, the birthmark, the inability to tolerate this little blemish leads to destruction.
Mm-hmm. Another objection that I have to the novel is Hawthorne's tendency to editorialize. He'll often interrupt his narrative and step in rather elephantine and ponderously and offer a generalized statement about humanity in general. Now, he's not...
You mean he sounds like a preacher at times?
Well, no, he's not here. He's not in these instances... limiting humanity to Salem, Massachusetts. He's saying that humanity is in general like this. For example, he's talking about the way people suffer, and he says the human beings are so constituted that, and I quote here, the sufferer should never know the intensity of what he endures by its present torture, but chiefly the pangs that rankle after it. And throughout the novel, he will just step in like that. He'll interrupt his narrative and offer these generalized comments, which I think are very suspect.
He'll not only give one interpretation, but he'll give many. For example, he'll say, perhaps if she felt this way, and then again, maybe she felt that way, and you go around for two paragraphs until you get back to the action.
Well, yes, Letitia, but he doesn't use the word perhaps. He used perchance or peradventure.
Yes. Yeah, good romantic diction. I think, I don't think there's any defense of him on that charge simply because he's writing within a set of conventions that allowed this kind of thing.
It is better than Scott or Cooper, at least.
Yes, I think it's better than Cooper by far.
Well, I think his insights are admirable. I think they're especially admirable in the way he traces the career of these three people. There's no doubt about it that Hester Prynne, at the end of the novel, is spiritually rejuvenated. Her punishment, I think Hawthorne remarks, Hester makes a pride of what the magistrates meant for punishment.
Yes.
And she does, and I think through her own courage,
through her integrity, she somehow transcends the horror of it all. Chillingworth, on the other hand, degenerates because of this revenge. And
Dimmesdale degenerates considerably, and then at the last moment realizes that his half measures are not going to work, mm-hmm. and nothing will substitute but the equivalent of Hester's open acceptance of her guilt, open confession. This is, I think, an interesting arrangement in a great many ways, because, of course, the person who is least involved directly in the adultery is the one who does not, is the one who eventually suffers the most, the worst consequences of it.
Mm-hmm.
It works Chillingworth's whole life. And the other two do find a salvation in it.
Mm-hmm. I think Dimmesdale is suffering from, we know he's suffering from this repression, but I often thought it was too bad that he couldn't have carried through Frau van Goethe's admonition that when I take this pleasure with too much prudence and circumspection, it ceases to be a pleasure for me. And that's about what
this is in the past again, yeah. As far as the novel is concerned.
I think there's a real melodramatic trick at the end of the novel when Chillingworth keeps saying to Dimmesdale, "You cheated me." In what way is he being cheated, Letitia? Is that clarified in the novel?
Certainly. When Dimmesdale steps on the scaffold, Chillingworth says, "This is the one place you can escape me."
Meaning what?
Meaning an open confession. That evidently Chillingworth would have chased him down all
at this over. Moment, the persecution ceases?
Yes.
And he delighted in persecuting the young man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. His Chillingworth is actually his pleasure in pursuing Dimmesdale is actually the most perverse behavior in the whole novel. But I wonder though, Hawthorne's presentation here, especially with that long opening chapter about the Customs House, seems to say that this is a general part of the American background. Do you feel that this is something we're still under the influence of, this puritanical persecution by guilt?
Oh, yes. Not long ago, there was a work published called The American Conscience, and a very scholarly man did the study, and he made a point of showing that contemporary American attitudes, ethical attitudes, derive from our puritanical heritage.
Do you think it also comes out, though, in ways close to Dimmesdale's of self-punishment? Isn't there a kind of holding ourselves up to punishment in this way?
Oh, yes. I think we have other substitutes nowadays, however. I don't want to be frivolous. We take up skin diving.
Skiing. Maybe this is more innocent than...
How do you feel, Letitia? You think that this is our heritage? This is our national conscience?
I guess I do, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think we're all haunted by it.
You've been listening to Offered with Comment. Offered with Comment is produced and moderated by Professors Arthur Wills and Thomas Mutch. Today's guest was Mrs. Bowman. The subject of next week's program will be 1984 by George Orwell. Offered with Comment was directed by Don Wheeler and originated in the studios of KUAC on the campus at College. This is the University of Alaska Broadcasting Service.